The medium is the message, body makes a dance. Love is the product, the joke is in, the joke is in, the joke is in your face.
I'm Are You Serious? And this is my show.
Natural disasters, and eventually the end of the world.
Are you serious?
Neil Gaiman is this British chap who happens to be in town this week, so we thought we'd have him over for a little chat. But in the meantime, I'm looking around and I see Jeff Deal, I see Steve Robles, and no surprises, I see Diana Brown.
You know, I have always wanted to say this, are you? Every time you do that, it reminds me of the romper room lady, and she would look into her magic mirror.
And there's my friends.
Exactly. Well, you know, speaking of television, if we see something on TV, it must be true, right? Okay, we don't really believe that, but Vernon Robinson is hoping we will. In his run for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 13th District of North Carolina, he's hoping to oust incumbent Democrat Brad Miller as... Jeff Deal has pointed out from 10 Cent Monkeys with some amusing campaign messages. Now, here's an example. From his TV ad, we quote Vernon Robinson saying, Brad Miller even spent your tax dollars to pay teenage girls to watch pornographic movies with probes connected to their genitalia.
This guy has my vote. I wish I was
your vote.
I wish I was located where you know.
Talking about? He's stealing all the. Those were all your campaign tricks from 2000.
I know.
I'm glad you're here to remember that, Mr. Yes. Robles. But this guy is pretty overwhelming. And if you have read the 10 Zen Monkeys article, you will know. And if you haven't, get your hiney over there and read it right now.
I'm glad you had a chance to mention 10 Zen Monkeys in this show, as I forgot to mention it in the introduction. But Jeff is signaling his approval of the fact that we have mentioned 10 Zen Monkeys.
It's true. That little trill you might have heard, it's like a triple. When Jeff is happy, he emits a little trill.
I want all political campaigns to be exactly like this. Does anybody else feel that way? I mean,
yeah,
I will be fabulous.
I don't see the point.
With masturbating old men? Or what,
well,
what
I mean, the kind of accusations thrown back and forth, they should be as surreal and extreme and bizarre as possible. And there hasn't been enough of that.
There are those.
There was somebody
saying,
who killed his opponent, I think, in 2004, wasn't there? Or there was an attempted murder.
It's not very humorous, though.
It's not quite as funny.
Just depending on how.
But Robinson, a rabid Republican who also happens to be an African American gentleman, I use the word gentleman loosely, in 2004 he lost his bid for the 5th District. But not before providing the locals with some high-concept political cabaret. Now, he's so far to the right that the Winston-Salem Journal declared him in an editorial, Jesse Helms is back, and this time he's black. Well, Robinson's campaign adopted this as their slogan.
Is he doing well?
No.
Not so much.
They haven't really polled very extensively, but I've read that they don't expect him to win.
No.
He has a history of pulling these tactics, and I guess the electorate there is sort of... you know, they've got a certain immunity to it. It's not as shocking to them as it is to, like, us.
Right, because we don't live in North Carolina.
Or as entertaining,
yes,
apparently.
Right. I'm wondering if you actually meant he was a rabid Republican. Like, maybe he got rabies from, like, shooting critters in the backyard.
You know,
or
that's
something.
A possibility. I mean, maybe you can't. Maybe it's passed that way from, you know, angry, small, beady-eyed, feral creatures from one to the next.
By angry, feral, beady-eyed creatures, I'm sure you mean Republicans.
You know, you can take that in whatever sense thou wilt, actually. This was another example of his politicking proclivities, I guess you'd say. This is a radio ad, and apparently it uses mariachi music as a soundtrack in the back, and then it's backed with this mariachi music, and he's going on saying, if Miller had his way, America would be nothing but one big fiesta for illegal aliens and homosexuals. And another, banjo music in the background. Hey, all you illegals, put your shoes on, go home. Don't come back now, you hear?
Is there any evidence that he attached the electrodes to the genitals of teenage girls? I mean,
personally.
Wait a minute. He said probes, man.
Probes?
I think you're putting in your own little
I'm fantasizing.
No,
it did happen. It was part of a National Institute of Health. slew of grants.
I see. He didn't personally probe.
I think he's a trailblazer, man. I think this is the road of the future. And I think pretty soon you'll just have like charges of bestiality and all kinds of fun stuff. And I can't wait.
Neil Gaiman probably needs no introduction, but we'll give you the short version. His DC Comics horror series Sandman won 9 Will Eisner Comic Industry Awards. His New York Times bestselling novel American Gods was awarded the Yuga, the Nebula, Locus, and the Bram Stoker. How about that? The Bram Stoker Award. I imagine
they actually call the horror people call them the Strokers.
Themselves. And you know what? What do they give you? I'm imagining a bucket full of viscous.
That
red,
would be really good. No, it's actually I will say on. It's one of the prettiest awards.
Is it really?
It's a little sort of haunted house designed by Gayan Wilson, and you open the door,
and
the name of the what's actually won the award is behind the little door. So it's kind of cool. It's much prettier.
That's real effort. Do they have a ceremony and all that?
They didn't really have much of one, but that's because I think they probably did have a reasonably good ceremony. The trouble was I'd logged onto their website that morning.
Right.
And their webmaster had been overly enthusiastic and put up the results. I'd just gone on to link to it on my blog.
Right.
And I wound up at 9 o'clock in the morning discovering that I'd won. And then had to go through the rest of the day pretending that I hadn't. And it was the only award ceremony I actually endured, as people come over and say, good luck. And through gritted teeth, I would say, thank you.
That's a borderline Hollywood kind of experience.
Absolutely.
As usual, one of my non-linear introductions, his most recent novel, Anansi Boys. That's one word, not two words, not Anansi Boys, but was another top seller. 2005 also saw the release of the film Mirror Mask, written by Neil and directed by Dave McKean, and he's now on tour for his most recent book, Fragile Things, Short Fiction and Wonders. And Diana and I are tag teaming since I finally caught up and wrote and read Anansi Boys, and she read
Fragile Things. An amazing
and welcome,
book.
Neil.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for coming. One of the things I love about your work is the importance of a figure like the trickster or the rascal that runs through pretty much everything. And it's like this figure, Mr. Nancy, appears in the last two novels. And it seems like this is the sort of person who can bring magic into the world. And perhaps it's a sort of character that we don't have room for anymore in America. Have you thought about that?
Oh, I think that a world in which we've got rid of... I think there are tricksters in America.
Well, there are,
I think they hang around the edges, which is the place that tricksters ought to be.
Right.
You don't want a trickster at the center of your life, because they will...
Or as president.
You definitely don't want a trickster as president. Although, I don't know, you'd have a really, really interesting country for 4 years.
Well,
or for possibly 3 or 4 weeks before he absconds with the with the money in the treasury.
It would keep Comedy Central really happy.
Do you think that fiction is really the only way to sort of express the value of that sort of character? I mean, you can't sort of write narrative... prose sort of justifying the trickster as easily as you can evoke him in fiction.
I think evoking the trickster is best done at short length. I mean, a novel like Anansi Boys, you know, Mr. Nancy, one of the best things you can say for him is he does die on page one and then hang around the novel refusing to go away, presence-wise. But I've always loved trickster stories. My favorites... obviously, the Anansi stories, I think, are wonderful. The Coyote stories.
Right.
Are marvelous. You know, you run into these stories where Coyote will get into an argument with a rock and lose. And actually, when
that's happened to me,
I love best about tricksters is they lose from time to time. Gods and heroes win. That's what heroes. If you run into a story with a hero in, they win until perhaps the very last time. They're allowed to sort of die and fire that final arrow into the air, or kill the person who's trying to kill them, and then die as well. But tricksters. Tricksters are just like the rest of us. They win sometimes, they lose sometimes, they screw up every bit as often as people do, only with more style.
Yes. And this really comes across in Anansi Boys, and the comedy of the fucking up basically comes across.
Anansi Boys, I think Anansi Boys is really sort of a comedy of embarrassment.
Exactly, particularly your main character.
Well, yes, which is why I wanted to write a character who was as English as he was American, if not more so, just because the English do embarrassment better. Mm. We have raised it to some kind of slightly awkward apologetic art form, whereas Americans understand the concept of embarrassment.
We just don't engage in it.
We don't. I was talking to a friend recently who was in England, and she was telling me that she was in England making out with an Englishman in a parking lot in the rain, and he refused. He got very, very scared and upset and wouldn't continue making out with her. And she said, why not? And I said, well, basically, it's because you are American, you were making out in a parking lot in a car in the rain, and your attitude is, anybody walking past, I don't know these people, what the hell, this is my life, go away. I said, his was the profound certainty that the moment that it matters went any further, not only would somebody knock on the window, but if he rolled the window down, it would be someone he knew, and standing just behind them would be everyone else he had ever met in his life, and they would be staring disapprovingly. And I said, and that's just how the English are built. We know that's true.
A sense of propriety still exists.
And a wonderful, magical, huge sense of a sort of conviction that the world is designed to make you slightly embarrassed and slightly ill at ease. But I actually like that. I mean, I wound up sort of trying to divide the lead character in Anansi Boys is divided between Fat Charlie, our hero,
right,
who is very English and very embarrassed, and his brother Spider, who is semi-fictional and somewhat godlike, and for whom the world just sort of sits up and begs and does more or less whatever he wants it to do. And neither of them is particularly grown up. And it's sort of a story about both of them.
The sense I get is that neither of them could be a whole person without the other one. And Charlie is perfect neurosis, and the other guy is like perfect pathology.
Psychosis.
Basically.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, I had the pleasure of reading your most recent book, Fragile Things, and obviously initially so struck by the title and your take on the title. And I'm quoting you on, the peculiarity of most things we think of as fragile is how tough they really are. And my favorite, you talk about eggshells and butterfly wings and hearts and dreams. And the line I liked best there was, even dreams, the most delicate and intangible of things, can prove remarkably difficult to kill. So what was your impetus to put this fabulous collection together and name it Fragile Things?
Well, the impetus to put it together was that the only thing that keeps me as a writer writing short fiction and enjoying it and convinces myself that it's okay to take time that I could otherwise spend on a novel or whatever, is the idea that every 8 years or so, I will go and look and put it all together, and I will have something book-like. So really the impetus was just the fact that it was 8 years, and I had enough stories, and it was time to put them all together in one place and see what they did, which is also something that's really cool for a writer, because you have no idea. You don't. The themes take you by surprise. The fact that you suddenly put all these stories together and they have something huge in common, that themes repeat. Every now and then, when I was reading it out loud, doing the audiobook, I discovered even occasional little phrases would repeat story to story. And I thought, should I take them out? And then I thought, no, I actually like the fact that I'd repeat
this resonance throughout.
A little phrase, you know, 8 years apart writing stories. That's a good thing, I think. What then gets harder once you've decided to put them together is, first of all, what order they go in.
Right.
How you order them, what begins the collection, what ends the collection, what happens in the middle. And I couldn't figure out how to do it. Eventually, I turned to my editor, and I said, Jennifer Braille, who's a wonderful editor, and I said, would you mind... I'm completely stuck. I have no idea what order I want these things to be in. Would you do me a list? Would you do me just a list of what you think they should be in? So she did. And she sent me her list. And I looked at it and I went, that's not right. And promptly put them into the right order.
That's the step you needed.
Needed somebody to send me a list and to go, what are you thinking of, woman? You know. So that was great. And suddenly I had an order. And the original title that this collection had in my head from about 8 years ago was always going to be called These People Should Know Who We Are and Know That We Were Here, and which is a quote from a Little Nemo cartoon.
Yes.
And that was my idea. And then it was all going to be first-person narratives, and it was all going to be unreliable narrators talking about their lives. And that was my idea for a short story collection. I thought, great, it'll be a sort of theme. And then I kept coming up with really good ideas for stories that couldn't follow that pattern. And then I kept telling people, I think my new short story collection is going to be called These People Should Know Who We Are and Tell That We Were Here. And everybody I'd tell that idea to would always look at me and they'd say, oh, nice title. A bit Dave Eggers, isn't it? And I go, well, yeah, but it's a quote from a Little Nemo. And eventually, one day, when I finally had sort of acknowledged that I didn't have a title for the collection.
Right.
I had written a song from a dream. It was one of those very few occasions where you wake up from a dream with words going around in your head and you just write them down. And they seem to be lyrics. And a band called One Ring Zero, who did a wonderful album where they'd come to a lot of authors and said, could you give us some words? And me, Margaret Atwood, Dave Eggers, all sorts of cool people. And I gave them these lyrics, which we called On the Wall. And there was just this little line in there that it said, I think that I would rather recollect a life misspent on fragile things than spent avoiding moral debt. And that line started haunting me. And I thought, I wonder what those fragile things would be. And started thinking about the nature of fragility and people and hearts and stories and all of the things we think of as fragile. And suddenly I realized that was the title of this collection, so it's called Fragile Things.
It's lovely.
Would that mean that the stories that you chose was based on the theme, or did you just do you tend to want to choose what you think are your best pieces?
Mostly, I just go out there and choose everything and put it into order. If there's something I'm really not satisfied with, I'll put it away and not put it in there. But I learned something huge and important. And my last short story collection. My last short story collection was called Smoke and Mirrors. Mm-hmm. And when it came out, it got lots of reviews. And because I'm a good author, I read the reviews, thinking I will learn something from this.
Right.
And all of the reviews said the same things. And what they said was that some of the stories in this anthology were absolutely terrific and powerful and wonderful, and a handful of them were so bad as to not, you know, Gaiman should not have published them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if there had been any agreement, reviewer to reviewer, about which constituted the brilliant ones and which constituted the ones that were so bad as to be unpublishable, I could have actually learned something. And what I took from that was that people's tastes change. Different people like different things. Chacun a son goût, as the French say, but they pronounce it better. And that really was the thing that I took from that, which is different people like different things. And if it was up to me, I would have left two or three short stories out of here, which I've already seen people listing as some of their favorites. And then there's at least a couple of stories in there that are some of my personal favorites, which very few people respond to, but those who do really, really like them. And that's fine, too.
Do you get responses as to, like, how people think about a piece or about a novel or how people think about a character where you hear what they think and you go, yeah, that means more to me now than the way I was thinking about it previously?
You definitely get... you definitely learn things from people. And I'm a writer who... I don't believe that my way of thinking about something is the only way.
Right.
And I love learning from what people think and what people take away. And sometimes people will, especially actually in a short story, they'll go and they'll find something in there about, and they'll say, this is what it means.
Right.
And you'll say, well, no, it doesn't. And then you'll look at it and you'll go, oh. And you realize, yes, it does. And but it's the thing, I remember reading an interview with Lou Reed where he was talking about listening to his old songs when he was putting them together for a compilation album and remixing a bunch of stuff and suddenly realizing what he'd been talking about at that time, and they were all addressing stuff that he was completely ignorant of while he was writing them. And I think it's very true that you really do wind up sometimes, you know, you're creating one art object on the surface, but it's also addressing whatever's obsessing you, whatever you're trying to deal with, whatever's filling your head, and that's normally too big to be seen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only when you get distance and you're beyond that you look back and you go, oh, you know, what I was trying to write about there was this or that.
Now, Forbidden Brides, it has a much longer title, but I'll use the truncated version. It was a story that you started writing when you were very young and had put away and then came back to it for Gothic! Yes?
Yep.
So what did you find as you revisited it? Did you find you were in a completely different headspace than you imagined at the time?
No. Actually, well, it was really weird. What had happened was I'd written this short story. I'd started writing it on East Croydon Station in the south of London at about 10:30 at night, waiting for a train in this ghastly waiting room that is no longer there. And I'd finished the story, I'd shown it to a few friends, expecting some kind of positive reaction because I thought it was really funny and clever. And the first person read it through and went, huh, and gave it back to me. And the second person I gave it to, I thought, okay, now I'll give it to somebody whose opinion I really respect. And she read it through and she said, it's facetious twaddle, dear. And gave it back to me. And I thought,
Brits have such a way with words, facetious twaddle.
And I thought, oh, well then, I thought. And I put it in a folder, and the folder then wound up in a large plastic tub in the attic. And if ever I thought of it, it was just with relief. You know, I'm so glad I didn't send that to an editor, and it didn't get published, and I didn't get embarrassed. And then I got this invitation to an anthology called Gothic, and I thought, I should write something Gothic. And then, out of the mists of memory, I thought, hang on, 20 years ago, I wrote a short story. I wonder if we can find it. And I asked my assistant, Lorraine. She went up to the attic and turned up with everything but the first page. And I asked which tub it was in, and she told me, and I went and looked, and eventually found the first page, which had become separated, and sat down and read it, and thought it was quite good. Actually, it was very good on the Gothic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was the one place it was terrible was the little place where I'd actually had to try and write a chunk of a modern novel.
Right.
Because at the age of 21 or 22, I hadn't read any modern novels. I just sort of had an idea of what they were probably like. So now I thought, oh, I can do that bit right. And after that, it was just a matter of sort of reining myself in. Occasionally there were places where the gags had gone too far, and occasionally there were places where I'd think, no, I should need a little colour there, need a little gag there, need something. So but I just typed it as if I was doing a second draft.
Oh.
And
20 years later, that's
20
fabulous.
Years later.
That's fabulous.
And then it won awards. And I thought...
A Bram Stoker?
No, alas, a Locus Award. It won the Locus Award as Best Short Story. And I thought for a moment about sending that to the nice lady who told me it was facetious twaddle.
Yes.
And then I thought, nah, I'll just make her buy me a drink the next time I see her.
There you are. I loved the device within that story of the writer desperately trying to write real, true to life fiction and keep degenerating into parody. Do you find yourself working within a particular construct of a story and then the story just insists on going in a completely different direction?
Oh, definitely. I you know, you ride the story wherever it'll go. And sometimes you run into enormous trouble if you have ideas about where a story will go and it's not going there. With the Nancy Boys, the novel, I was about halfway through it. It was going completely on track. I had an idea. I knew where the plot was going. I knew everything about it. And I'm writing away very happily. And suddenly, I've got a character going up in an elevator, or as we call them in England, a lift, to see another character. And I thought, hang on, if you go up to see him and you have the conversation over the next two pages I think you're going to have, he's going to kill you. That's not part of the plot. That's not even where I thought this story was going. That makes it much darker, and that derails everything, and we can't... And suddenly a bunch of people who... characters who I'd thought of almost as wallpaper.
Right.
I'd thought of as sort of they were there, but they were fun, came up and started doing things.
I love that character, the Mr. Coates, absentively and all that. I feel as if I've met that guy, and maybe you have as well.
I loved writing him. Yeah. I don't know what that says about me, that I took enormous joy in writing a character who was everything that I could hate. And then when I couldn't think of anything else, I'd throw in another trait. And He's every crooked agent that I've ever had or encountered.
That's what I was thinking. Yes.
You
can bond over that as well, fellow authors dealing with your agents.
You know, I'm lucky in that I've had some very, very good agents. But, you know, every now and then you wind up with a very, very rotten apple. Or you see friends of yours winding up with rotten apples. Right. And, you know, and I'm not the only one. Poor Douglas Adams. I remember going to see Douglas once, and he looked very, very down in the dumps. And I said, "Are you all right? What's wrong?" And he said, "Well," he said, "I've just discovered that my accountant," he said, "has just advised me to buy this new house and various other things, and told me I was fine. Had actually cleaned out my bank account, and having been caught, had just killed himself." And I said, "Oh, sorry about that. You know, it's." Don't really know what to say. But so I with slightly crooked agents at the best of times have never had it as bad as some of my friends have.
Well, you got the opportunity at least to turn it into quite an amusing character.
Absolutely.
Who gets his,
or absentively, as he would say.
Gets his comeuppance in the end. We should break for a moment and hear some music, and we'll be right back with Neil Gaiman.
Are you serious?
Hey now, my red clouds are rolling in to catalog and number every stone cold dream. And I've seen Sal Thumb in his way up to the stars, seen angels in the chutes and galleries and heroes in the bars. And I've seen a death warrant out on the moon. I saw what happened when the prophet spoke too soon, and I heard the radio sneeze into the evening, and all the bat squeak singers selling fake hope to the sleeping. I've seen the cover up of cold hard facts, and they're burning acid holes in the magazine racks. And I saw Jenny have a baby in the street, where they're playing blind man's bluff between the dying and the concrete. I've seen a paper corpse holding up a doorway. I heard the lonely voices singing, yeah, I did it your way. And I held the future up to a looking glass. It bears a striking resemblance to the embers of the past. I've seen the chorus girls, the ribbons and the rocks. Seen electoral debates on the steel rim of a whiskey shot. And I caught the glimmer in a hurricane's eye. I've seen these AK-47s with their noses to the sky. And the orchids got promises tattooed to the insides of my eyelids. And I'll be watching when the Richter reaches 10. I bled by these weapons, babe, and now I'm one of them.
In Fragile Things, there's a wonderful poem that you describe as not much of a poem, but enormous fun to read aloud. So would you read it for us?
Of course. This is called The Fairy Reel. If I were young as once I was, and dreams and death more distant then, I wouldn't split my soul in two and keep half in the world of men. So half of me would stay at home and strive for fairy in vain, while all the while my soul would stroll up narrow path down crooked lane, and there would meet a fairy lass and smile and bow with kisses three. She'd pluck wild eagles from the air and nail me to a lightning tree. And if my heart would run from her or flee from her, be gone from her, she'd wrap it in a nest of stars. And then she'd take it on with her, until one day she'd tire of it, all bored with it, and done with it. She'd leave it by a burning brook, and off brown boys would run with it. They'd take it and have fun with it, and stretch it long and cruel and thin. They'd slice it into four, and then they'd string with it a violin. And every day and every night they'd play upon my heart a song so plaintive and so wild and strange that all who heard it danced along, and sang and whirled and sank and trod, and skipped and slipped and reeled and rolled until, with eyes as bright as coals, they'd crumble into wheels of gold. But I am young no longer now. For 60 years my heart's been gone to play its dreadful music there beyond the valley of the sun. I watch with envious eyes and mind the single-souled who dare not feel the wind that blows beyond the moon, who do not hear the fairy reel. If you don't hear the fairy reel, they will not pause to steal your breath. When I was young, I was a fool. So wrap me up in dreams and death.
Lovely. Very musical.
Utterly beautiful. You start the book with A Study in Emerald, a fabulous literary mashup in which Sherlock Holmes meets the world of H.P. Lovecraft. And I have to ask, I mean, what is your favorite Lovecraft story?
Oh, my favorite Lovecraft story at this exact moment, as you asked me, which might not be my favorite Lovecraft story the next time somebody sticks a microphone in my face, is probably The Outsider. Just because it was the first. And it... And I had no idea what to expect. And all of a sudden, I'm climbing up in the darkness with somebody, and he's been down in this dark place, and he's climbing up and up and up and up and up, and he finally comes into the sunlight and comes out, and everybody who sees him starts screaming, and we realize he's a horrible creature, and he goes back down, and it's an incredibly simple sort of plot idea, and it completely took me by surprise and told me that I was with an author who would take me to strange places and who I trusted and who I could, and for whom everything was atmosphere. I mean, the joy of Lovecraft, it's not plot. You don't read Lovecraft for those brilliant twists and turns. You just read it because...
to be immersed in it.
You are. You're adrift on this clotted adjectival froth that floats on top of the story, and it carries you away.
So true.
Is that where your roots are in works like that, Lovecraft and fantasy and so forth? Or?
I don't know where my roots are. I'm very lucky in that my roots are all over the place. When I was a kid, I read everything. I was, for example, enormously lucky. Oh, I didn't know it at the time, but I was. In going to a school in England, where as far as I could tell, they had the most money to spend on books for the school library in about 1920. And then the budget, I think, got cut a lot in about 1930, which meant that I had an absolutely terrific grounding as a kid who just read his way through the school library in late Edwardian, you know, pre-war literature. I had no idea that everybody didn't know this stuff. You just sort of, it was the stuff that was on the shelves, and I pulled it down and I read it. And on the same shelves were, they had the first two books, battered, red, old hardcovers, bought when they came out, of Lord of the Rings. They had the Fellowship of the Ring, and the Two Towers was there. And so I read them, too. They obviously had run out of money by the time it came to buy The Return of the King. So I never knew how it ended. I'd just go back and reread these two books over and over again. Actually, I won the school English prize when I was 12, and they said, you get book tokens, but we will actually go and get you a book. And I said, well, there's this thing called The Return of the King, and I have to find out how this thing ends. So I think probably the only hardback copy of Return of the King sold in 1973 was to my school. And they gave it to me.
Lovely.
Since you raised Paul McHenry?
Yeah, oh. Actually. One of the things that I wanted to talk to you about was Gods Who've Fallen on Hard Times. Because that's really what American Gods goes on in American Gods and Anansi Boys. And you're revisiting it with the comic book that's coming out right now, The Eternals. Is that why you went back to The Eternals? Is that, did you decide?
No, not really. Although, thematically, it all seems to be of an odd kind of piece with things. But the... I mean, it was definitely a theme that began in Sandman. I can point to Calliope in Sandman 17 about a muse who's been kept prisoner. There's definitely all of the gods, or most of the gods in Sandman, are gods who are no longer believed in, no longer worshipped, and no longer anywhere near as powerful as they would like to be. And then in The Kindly Ones, I wrote this sort of weird rant that Loki has as he's killing a young lady, and he just does this whole rant about the new gods and the gods of mortuary and ambulance and the gods of freeway and television. And I thought, you know, there's something here that I think I'm trying to say. And that all stewed until one day I was in Iceland on a plane stopover. I was going from Minneapolis to Norway, and I discovered that I could actually stop over in Iceland for 24 hours. So I did. And I also had this plan that I'd keep going until it got dark. And I didn't realize that on June the 23rd in Iceland, you don't get any dark. So now I've been, by this point, I've been awake for about 36 hours. And I was looking, I was in a tourist office in Iceland looking at some little maps of the Viking incursions into Newfoundland and back. And I just thought, I wonder if they left their gods behind. And it was just that one little moment of, and I walked back to the hotel and I started typing an outline, and I wrote American Gods at the top and then explained in the thing this was just a working title and I'd find a better title when I got going, and just sort of outlined it. Suddenly I thought, okay, this is something I can do, a road trip. I can talk about the America that's been fascinating me, and I can talk about the fact that there are things that are missing in America that feel almost spiritually missing. It's the weirdness of the way that you'd never get the kind of Halloween celebrations that you get in America in the parts of England that I grew up in as a kid. Because when I was a kid on Halloween, the old country folk, they didn't go out. you know, that was the night that stuff happened and things were abroad. You stayed home. The idea that they have huge parties and dress up weird, you wouldn't want to attract that much attention. And I thought, well, that's sort of something that can go in there. And the American predilection towards giant roadside attractions.
The enormous ball of twine.
The enormous ball of twine. The House on the Rock. All of those kind of things which seemed somehow to fulfill the same kind of place in the soul that the holy places of Europe and Asia that then became
Stonehenge.
Temples.
Okay.
Yes, they're not quite Stonehenge. So that all began there. And then when that was done, I really wanted to tell the Anansi Boys story, which wasn't really... which is much less a story of God's fallen on hard times and much more just a story of how your family is embarrassing. And really, it was... which was something that came, I suppose, mostly out of me being a parent. Mm. My daughter, Maddie, who is quite wonderful. I adore her. When she turned 8, I became embarrassing. Everything I did was embarrassing. Breathing on the same street that she and some friends were on could be an embarrassing thing if I did it. I would have to drop her off a block from school because I drove a Mini and nobody else drove a Mini, and this was embarrassing. And I also had to turn off the radio or turn off the CD player before I opened the car to let her out because nobody else listened to the kind of weird music that I listened to. And Dad, don't you know how embarrassing that is? So, and I thought, this is so cool. Because I realized I did the same to my dad, you know, who, when I was about her age, proudly ordered a pair of special yellow shoes that he proclaimed were the most comfortable shoes from some European thing. And they looked like giant bananas. I wouldn't walk within 14 feet of him if he was wearing the banana shoes. I'd try and pretend other people were my parents, and I don't know that man with those yellow shoes. So I thought, okay, it's a family thing. It's just what families do, and I need to try and write that. And God seemed like a lovely way of ramping up the... just sort of supercharging it, of giving it more weight, more power, and emphasizing things, because that's one of the things that gods do. It's the great thing about gods in stories and in our sort of collective consciousness is they embody something. And that's how you use them, as an embodiment. So Anansi as the trickster, as a god of stories, of storytelling, of loose... as a god who would go out and pick up loose women, as a god who would come home drunk. This was somebody I wanted in my story. For the Eternals, it's much more of a sort of weird upside-down kind of thing, because that came because Joe Quesada, who's the editor-in-chief at Marvel, came to me and said, I was always going to do another project for Marvel, and I wasn't quite sure what it was going to be. And Joe said, would I take the Eternals? And... which were these wonderful things that Jack Kirby, the genius of comics, the great powerhouse of comics, had created in about 76. And at the time, Marvel had sort of pulled the plug on it after about 18 issues, and that was that, and it hadn't really gone anywhere at the time. And then they'd tried to incorporate these characters into the Marvel universe, and they'd made rather a bish up of it. It was messy, and I was trying to explain it on stage the other night in New York, being interviewed by John Hodgman, and I described it to the audience as being like somebody mating a prize greyhound with a hamster. You had something that would neither win races nor look cute in a little plastic ball, which is the kind of desperate analogy you only come up with on a stage in front of 700 people. But you know, it didn't really work. And Joe basically said, "Look, could I take this thing and just try and give it back to them in such a way that they could use it?" And I said yes. And immediately, my head went to the place that you were talking about, Paul, of just, okay, it's going to be this cool thing filled with gods through history, these decayed gods. Okay, I can do this in my sleep. This is going to be fun. And then when I read more of what they'd done to the Eternals over the years and how far it had drifted from the thing that Jack Kirby created, I thought, actually, I'm going to spend my story time seeing if I can just sort of clean off the detritus and leave it buffed up and shiny and ready for other people to use, but now having a place in the Marvel Universe. So I may get to go back and do more of those stories. I hope I will.
Since you raised comic strips, two other Englishmen, I believe, Grant Morrison and Alan Moore, both are very sort of outspoken about their beliefs in the occult and psychedelic drugs and all kinds of weirdness. And
Alan worships an imaginary Roman snake god.
My.
Right on.
And I hope that's me.
I remember the day that Alan, I was sitting at home and the phone rang. And Alan, who had always been a devout rationalist up until that time, I mean, to the you know, a man who would have made Penn and Teller feel that they were, you know, believers in superstition. Alan phoned me up and he said, "Oh, Neil, listen, it's my 40th birthday next week. And I've been thinking, and I've decided to get my midlife crisis over with. So I'm becoming a warlock, and I'm going to be worshipping an imaginary Roman snake god. Just thought you'd like to know, mate. All right?" And it's like, that is so cool.
That's kind of lovely, isn't it?
Yes, unfortunately, I have to say that him having done that, you know, it's like growing a really long beard. Every now and then I think, wouldn't it be nice to grow a really long beard? I think that Alan's done it. Right. And he's done it so much better than we have. So I can't actually ever imagine myself now becoming... Because if I became, you know, a sort of psychedelic warlock, people just go, "Oh, he's just doing Alan Moore."
Does it ever surprise you that so much weirdness managed to leak its way into the world of comic books?
No, not at all. We are wonderfully weird people. We wouldn't be doing comics.
I've always been, but and yet
the people doing comics. Actually, it's not true these days. It's not as true these days, which I think is actually a pity. I will occasionally meet people who explain to me that they are going into comics as a career move, which is like somebody telling you they're going to live in Belgium as a career move. You know, it's just wrong. Those of us who did comics up until the 90s, I'd say mostly early 90s, got into comics because it was a really cool, strange, odd place that nobody was watching.
That's what I was thinking, exactly. And to some extent, nobody is watching in terms of...
Except it's still a big cult. Well, yeah. I don't think it's a cult anymore. I think it's now hit the status of religion. It may fall back to cult. But comics is, you know, it's this weird world now where you pick up magazines, newspapers, online reviews, and places that are reviewing stuff will just cheerfully review comics alongside everything else, which was the battle that we were fighting for 25 years ago. The idea of being sold in the bookshops, that was part of the battle. You know, as far as the likes of me and Alan and Grant and the rest of us are concerned, who were out there then, we are now living in the golden age. This is utopia. There are Zeppelins and flying cars and a cure for cancer now in this perfect future. Yeah. This is the golden age, because this really is what we dreamed would happen. Back in 86, nobody was reading comics. You know, I remember the sheer, amazed, befuddled joy when we in England discovered that Kathy Acker read comics for pleasure. And it was just like, it was magic. It was so cool. Look, she's sort of a weird, almost part of the literary establishment. And she
almost
reads Love
a legitimate
and Rocket. Yes.
Intellectual.
She would
love to hear that.
It's true. She was almost illegitimate. And she read Love and Rockets. And And she'd gotten to a line, as you know, she'd actually gone and got her copies of Dark Knight signed by Frank Miller at a signing. That
beautiful.
That was so cool. And one reason it was so cool was it didn't happen. It was unheard of, the idea of somebody from that world coming and visiting ours or treating ours seriously. These days, everybody reads comics. You know, I mean, I go to a big author event or book expo or something like that, and all these authors sort of sidle over, and they don't just sidle over, and they're you know, sort of these award-winning famous authors, they sidle over and they ask me how they can get into the business. You want to say, go away, you latecomers. We want none of you. Yes,
also
we
Rans.
Spurn you.
Yeah, anybody who's anybody has to do a graphic novel, that I guess, isn't that?
Exactly.
And actually, Ari's working on one.
Everybody. Well,
I just started a few seconds ago.
But it is kind of true, and to be honest, I actually like it. I think it's wonderful. I love the fact that we're in a world in which, you know, you could get Michael Chabon and Will Eisner collaborating on a comic. That's magic. I love the fact that we're in a world in which Art Spiegelman is taken absolutely as seriously as anybody else in American letters.
And deservedly.
And absolutely deservedly. And I think that's great. But it really is... It's so easy to forget what it was like when I came in.
True.
You know, the editor of Time Out magazine in London came over to me recently, the guy who was editing back then. He said, I only ever made one huge mistake in my entire editing career, he said, which was when you did the big article on Watchmen and comics, and Dave Gibbons drew a new cover and everything like that for Time Out in 1986, and I went with the dance troupe on the cover. Instead of going with comics as the cover, he said, because we would have been the first. We actually would have broken the whole thing, and it would have been... And I said, yes. And, you know, and the reason that you didn't is why you weren't. So...
Well, I think we're almost running out of time.
There's just one last thing. In the beginning of Locks, you begin it with a line that you say is as close to a credo as you'll ever have. Will you share that with us and talk about it for a moment?
It's that we owe it to each other to tell stories. And I think that we really do. I think that our stories is not just our personal stories, it's not just what we've experienced, but it's those stories that we've learned, it's what we've taken from people before us, it's those stories, oral stories, and the things that you can give as stories. We owe it to each other to pass those stories on.
That's beautiful.
And I have one thing to wrap up with. I loved the Mirror Mask, the film, and it didn't get great reviews. Is it harder to do fantasy of this sort in film because it's so easy to do it in film?
No, I don't think. I mean, Miramar's got really interesting reviews, which is to say, it got what I believe are technically known as mixed reviews.
Right.
In that a lot of people thought it was awful and a few people loved it.
Right.
And that really was kind of how it was made. Dave McKean. It was made with this very, very strange upside-down thing of the Jim Henson Company coming to Dave McKean and saying, if we give you $4 million, could you give us a fantasy movie kind of like Labyrinth, which cost $40 million in the 1980s? Right. And Dave saying, okay. And then Dave coming up with a story, me working, basically giving him dialogue for it, and him taking that away and making this amazing art object. But I think that Mirror Mask, even when we were making it, we knew that we were making something that a lot of people wouldn't like.
Right.
And then for a few people, it would be their favorite thing in the world. And I like that. I have to say, I like the other thing too. It's always fun. You know, the films that we've got coming out, or that I've got, sort of I'm involved with, that are coming out over the next few years. There's a Stardust movie that's going to come out in March. There's a Beowulf movie that'll be out in October. And those are movies that I hope that lots of people like.
What I really wanted to know about is you're doing something with Terry Gilliam, who is absolutely one of my favorite directors.
Bless. I hope it happens. Terry has been working for many years on Good Omens, which is the novel that Terry Pratchett and I wrote.
Yeah.
About the end of the world.
Yes.
Absolutely. It's just come out in... originally, it used to be out in England as by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman, because he was more famous, and then over here as by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett, because I was more famous. But then I got more famous over there, and Terry got more famous over here. So
now what to do?
So we brought it out over here in the black and white cover. Mm. So the black cover is by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman, and the white cover is by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. But in England, where they're cheap, they've actually designed a cover that is reversible, and you turn the book upside down, and one way it's by me and him, and the other way it's by him and me, and on the spine it reverses.
That's beautiful.
Stuff. So really, it's by, you know, with luck, there will be twice as many copies on the bookshelf, and the me fans will find it, and the Terry fans will find it, because that's always the thing that you want both sets of readers to find the book. Terry Pratchett, Terry Gilliam, rather, has loved the book for years. He has been working on it for a while. He recently came to us and said, okay, I'm going to get the rights back to the script that I wrote with a guy called Tony Grissoni a few years ago. He said, what is it going to cost me to get the option for myself? And Terry Pratchett and I put our heads together and we thought, well, we really want Terry Gilliam to make it. We want this to be a Terry Gilliam film. We don't want it to be an anybody else film. Sure. We've said no to lots and lots of people who seem to want to make it into a cool big commercial film. We like the idea of it being a Terry Gilliam film. So we put our heads together and we decided that it should cost him a groat each. And I don't believe they've actually made groats, which is an old English coin worth about fourpence, since about sort of, you know, the 1780s, which means that he is going to have to go to eBay.
He's going to have to do some searching.
Yes.
Well,
magical quest.
They're cheap. I mean, frankly, they're really cheap. We figured it out that we were actually going to need farthings for our agents to pay the agent commission on a groat.
Fair.
And I went to eBay, picked up a farthing for practically nothing.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you so much.
And please come back again.
I would love to.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Love's the only weapon. Shit!
Are you serious?